Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza announced by Israel that starts on Thursday after Israeli raids that have killed 220 Gazans and wounded close to 1,800 in response to the 1,200 rockets fired at Israel by Hamas that have killed one Israeli. Khaled El-Gindi, a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel, joins us to discuss Hamas's acceptance of this ceasefire after having ignored the last one brokered by Egypt. Then we'll go to London to speak with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. We'll discuss the testimony she gave on Wednesday to a committee of the UK Parliament on the new BRICS Development Bank and the EU summit underway in Brussels that will increase sanctions against Russia over Ukraine following the just-announced increased sanctions by the US targeting major Russian banks, defence and energy firms. Then finally, we will speak with Rachel Pearson, a six-year MD-PhD student at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Institute for the Medical Humanities. We will discuss the xenophobic, racist claims on Fox News that diseases are, quote, carried across the border by this tsunami of illegals, and her article at the Texas Observer, Disease Threat from Immigrant Children Wildly Overstated, as well as the fact that the children from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador crossing the border have a higher rate of immunization against mumps, measles, rubella, polio, tetanus, and diphtheria than children in Texas, where one in six are uninsured. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously serves as advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And Israel has announced that we'll observe a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza on Thursday, and Hamas have announced that they will also observe the ceasefire. Obviously, they ignored the last one by Egypt, but this one, I think, is largely brokered by the UN, is it not?
That's correct. And it is, as far as I know, only 6 hours in duration. So it's not an actual ceasefire as much as it is just a temporary suspension for the delivery of humanitarian goods and services.
And does this relate to the people that have been asked to evacuate from the north of Gaza? I mean, is there any is this a factor, giving people time to get to more safer places? Not that there's too many safe places left. It's a pretty small piece of territory we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I have no idea what the motivation or intention behind it is. I'm not privy to, you know, internal Israeli military discussions, but I think it is. The point you made is absolutely correct. There's virtually nowhere in the Gaza Strip that is safe. It is the most densely populated region of the world. It is a tiny sliver of land surrounded by Israel on 50% of its borders with Israel, a long stretch of coast to the Mediterranean, and a short 5-kilometer strip, border strip with Egypt. So it's a very, very tiny enclave with nearly 2 million people. And what we've seen is that nowhere and nobody really is safe from being targeted.
So, and of course, the four children were killed by an Israeli strike on a beach near Gaza. They were children belonging to a fisherman playing on the beach, and that was right next to where a Western journalist was staying. So it's clear that the international outrage is growing over this. But so what is Hamas's motivation then for, one, not accepting the last ceasefire with Egypt, and two, accepting this narrow one, which is basically only a window in which to get some humanitarian aid in? What is their game plan, if they have one?
Well, that's just it. I'm not sure that they have a full-blown strategy, per se. But the one thing that this lull tomorrow morning achieves, actually, for both sides, is an opportunity to sort of regroup, to think rationally, and give some time for a diplomatic solution, or at least some sort of truce to be brokered. So I think, in addition to allowing some humanitarian space, it's also opening up at least a window for a political process, because at the same time, tomorrow there is an Israeli delegation that is headed to Cairo, which is the center of the ceasefire discussions on all sides. You already have the Palestinian president in Cairo talking with his counterparts in Hamas, and you have Israelis and Egyptians talking to each other. So I think it also gives some space for, you know, for some political process. Otherwise, I fear that if something is not reached soon, then things will escalate much more dramatically, I'm afraid.
And again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. But clearly there is, seems to me at least, given the fact that there's this split within Hamas where there's a political wing and a military wing, and apparently the military wing were the ones that broke the ceasefire, whether against the wishes, it appears, of the political wing. And it seems to me, I just was watching television earlier, Khaled, and I saw Naftali Bennett, a member of the war cabinet of Netanyahu's, talking with Wolf Blitzer. And he's a real hardliner, and the hardliners in Israel are in the ascendancy now, it would seem, both in their politics and perhaps even in the culture of the country. And it just seems there's a symbiosis here between these. I don't understand. I mean, Hamas means zeal, does it not, in Arabic? Right. They seem that would define them as hardliners. Is that what this is slipping into, a kind of slugfest? A symbiosis between hardliners?
I think that's an accurate description. I mean, I think one of the things that's very often overlooked in looking at the situation is Hamas generally is seen as an extremist organization. They're religious fundamentalists. They have carried out attacks on civilians. They're extremists. But at the same time, people fail to see that you have an Israeli ruling coalition that is dominated by right-wing extremists, people who openly oppose a peaceful settlement with Palestinians based on two sovereign states, people who are committed to the settlement project at any cost. And these are the people making decisions of life and death and war and peace in the Israeli cabinet. So, yes, I think the discourse is dominated, unfortunately, on both sides, by extremists, and violence tends to reinforce the hardliners' positions because it reaffirms the worst the worst perceptions of your adversary. So it's a cycle; it sort of just feeds on itself.
But the Palestinian people, particularly those in Gaza, are trapped in by this extremist government of religious fanatics called Hamas. And it would seem to me that if the people were given some hope that that conditions could improve, because at this point all that happens is the screws are turned on and you can't get cement, you can't get water, you can't get food, you can't fish, there's just about nothing you can do. Wouldn't it make more sense, the best way to get rid of Hamas would be to give the Palestinian people an alternative vision and some concrete steps that would indicate to them that, because I can't believe that the people in Gaza, with bombs raining down on them, are very happy with how Hamas. It defies logic that they would be.
It's true. I mean, the ironic thing is that before this crisis, polls and sort of anecdotal evidence were pointing to the fact that Palestinians in Gaza were sort of growing tired of Hamas. Hamas had no end game. Their finances had dried up. They looked to be sort of behaving the way the Palestinian Authority was in the West Bank as Israel's security subcontractor, preventing rocket fire. So they weren't doing anything on the resistance front. They're not very successful on the governance front. They're not very democratic to begin with. There were crackdowns against opponents of the Hamas government or criticism, curtailing freedoms. So there was this growing discontent with Hamas before the crisis. What's happened since then is, since Hamas is bearing the brunt, actually the Palestinians in Gaza are bearing the brunt of this war, 80% of those killed and injured are civilians. But Hamas is also paying a price, both in human terms and politically, militarily, and otherwise.
And internationally, too, right? They're totally isolated internationally.
No, absolutely. But because they're bearing the brunt, and at the same time, they're seen as, they're not risk-averse. They are lobbing rockets at Israel, as ineffective as they may be, as indiscriminate as they may be. But they're seen as, at least they're doing something. So the reality is that Palestinians have actually become more sympathetic toward Hamas since the start of this crisis, certainly in the West Bank, but also in Gaza. And that's especially when compared with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who throughout this crisis has looked impotent and ineffective and unable to affect any sort of outcome on the ground. So, the irony is that people were unhappy with Hamas, but when they're under attack, the tendency is to rally together, is sort of close ranks and rally around your leaders, even if they're bad ones. So that's something that I think the Israeli leadership and certainly the American leadership rarely take into account.
And what is Abbas doing? He's going to Egypt, right, and then to the Gulf. What's the agenda? He said he was meeting with Hamas. Who's he meeting with? Presumably not the military wing, but
with the political wing, and of course they're, I'm sure, in touch with the Hamas leadership inside Gaza, and the hardliners, I should point out, are not entirely from the military wing. There's also a political leadership inside Gaza that tends to be very hardline. The fault line is really between the Palestinian leadership in exile and the leadership that is inside. Certainly, the military wing is the most militant of that group. But as far as Mahmoud Abbas, he is focusing his efforts on Egypt. He'll be going to the Gulf, but primarily, his focus is on Egypt.
By the way, he's going to Turkey as well, isn't he?
Yes, right. He is. He's going to the countries where that have influence with Hamas, in addition to talking to them directly. So the two main outside regional actors that Hamas has been wanting to bring into this process are Turkey and Qatar in the Gulf. Because they are seen as much more sympathetic to Hamas than the Egyptian regime, which is quite hostile.
Right, and that's because of they're both sympathetic to Muslim Brotherhood, who the Egyptian military government have outlawed.
Right, and overthrew last year.
Right,
and so that's part of this this equation, the shift in the regional balance has affected the internal balance of Palestine within Palestinian politics and the dynamics between Hamas and Israel.
So, but at the same time, in terms of on the ground in both the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian attitude is when Israel is attacking, they rally around the flag, if you will. And that
right.
You were just saying a minute ago that the leadership, presumably Abbas, is pretty impotent. And so, again, how much, though, is this an attempt by Netanyahu and the right-wing coalition, which they've, from day one, they've said they won't accept a government with Hamas in it. Are they still going to try and split off Hamas from this unity government?
They may. I mean, Netanyahu's government has made very clear that they want to destroy the Palestinian unity government, technically not a unity government, but the unity agreement and the National Reconciliation Accord between Hamas and Fatah and the other factions. And I think they would very much prefer to deal with Gaza and the West Bank separately. But that runs counter to Palestinian national interests and frankly has been bad for Israel and the peace process. I mean, as long as you have Hamas as an independent actor that is accountable to no one, that is beyond the reach of a central Palestinian authority or government, then it will be impossible to try and control or influence its actions. But if you bring Hamas and it has a stake in a unified, cohesive Palestinian political polity, then you're much more likely to be able to incentivize them at least to not be disruptive. So it boggles my mind why Israel and the United States insist on opposing a Palestinian national unity when it is, perfectly compatible with a two-state solution and, in fact, a prerequisite for one, and, B, it is in the interest of both Israel and the peace process to do so.
And I think if conditions improved in Palestine, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, Hamas's influence would be diluted. I mean, they should never have got elected. It was only because the Bush administration insisted on that election going ahead. I remember Condoleezza Rice was blindsided by it. I mean, I guess you can't blame the people for voting for them because the choice was between the Salvation Army and the Mafia, you know. So,
but yeah, well, that's not a totally inaccurate description. But even more to the point, you know, the choice is between a new group that was untested and had a reputation for not being corrupt, and the guys who have been in power for as long as anyone who can remember, who've consistently failed.
Right.
So it was a, you know, look at it in simple political science 101 terms.
Sure.
If the party that always fails is running against the new guys are probably going to win. So
plus they were more disciplined. They only ran one candidate per electorate, whereas the Fatah being a patronage system, everybody wanted to be a candidate.
Well, Hamas has its patronage system too.
Right.
They just were more disciplined, as you said, and more organized and more strategic. Fatah basically had this sense of entitlement. They got lazy. They got complacent. And so they didn't run as rigorously as they probably should have, and they lost.
And the U.S. wasn't watching minding the store. I think that was the point I wanted to make. But I thank you for joining us, Khaled. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate it.
Welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break, be back and go to London to talk with somebody who just briefed the UK Parliament. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And she just briefed a committee of the UK Parliament today on the BRICS. Now, tell us what you told the British parliamentarians about the new BRICS bank that was just announced.
Well, it's been a very important week for the BRICS because yesterday they've announced the creation of two institutions, the new BRICS Development Bank with a capital of up to $100 billion, of which they're contributing $50 billion, and a credit reserve arrangement of another $100 billion. And I outlined in more detail, particularly the new development bank, this is going to be called, which I think is a really important institution, both in terms of filling major gaps in infrastructure throughout the developing world and in having a new governance structure where developing and emerging economies will have a far greater voice than in the Bretton Woods institutions. But I think particularly important is this having additional institution that will help build infrastructure which is much needed in the developing world.
And in terms of this being an alternative to the World Bank and the IMF, what is the, in a sense, the record of the World Bank and the IMF? Has anybody done a real accounting of where all that money went and what we have to show for it?
Well, there are a lot of assessments, and I think overall, actually, the balance is quite positive, but there have been several problems. One is the excessive conditionality of the institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which has tended to follow an excessively free market model, focusing often on privatization, capital account liberalization, and so on. And in the case of the World Bank, more in areas like privatization as preconditions of making loans. And although there has been some improvement in this, what hasn't really improved is the governance, because emerging economies, particularly the Asian ones, are very heavily underrepresented, whereas countries like European ones are overrepresented. And there has been some agreement to change that lack of balance, but unfortunately, the U.S. Congress blocked it. And although the Obama administration took this new legislation to the U.S. Congress, it hasn't been approved. And this has, of course, irritated these BRICS countries like China and India, because they are now major actors in the world economy. China is the second largest economy. Some people say it might overtake the U.S. this year. And India is the third largest. And yet they're very badly underrepresented in these institutions. And because they have such high levels of savings and such high levels of foreign exchange reserves, they can afford to create these new banks. They don't just have to talk about these things, but they can actually do it themselves. And they have actually done it. And so it's actually, it's a very exciting moment for these countries. And it has huge potential. It has huge potential for both changing world governance, global governance, and providing additional sources of financing for infrastructure.
Well, the initial $50 billion into this new development bank that the BRICS are setting up comes equally from each of the partners, which, of course, are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And there's certainly no equivalence there in terms of China, is because obviously the richest of all of those countries, particularly in terms of its reserves. And the bank's headquarters will be in Shanghai, China. Over the long run, can, for example, South Africa, it can't match China's resources, and Russia's resources are being pretty much stretched at the moment too.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, there is this big asymmetry. For example, when the EU was created, you had countries of a similar size in Germany and France, later the UK. But here, there is this huge asymmetry. China's economy is far larger, as you say, than about 20 times larger than South Africa. And, of course, they have much higher reserves. I mean, the Chinese have about $4 trillion of reserves, over $1 trillion in sovereign wealth funds. So initially, the Chinese wanted really to have a higher share so that also the bank could be bigger. But the other countries were nervous about having a bank so dominated by China. So they have agreed a bank where they all have, as you said, equal shares. But the cost of that is that they will... The bank will not be as large as it could have been. But what will be interesting is that the Chinese, A, can contribute trust funds. Like even in the World Bank, you have trust funds, and if a country wants to contribute more, you create like a little subsidiary, and there. But the governance of the institution would be equal. And also the Chinese are creating the Asian Infrastructure Fund, where they will be more dominant. So you have a kind of more complex geometry, but the BRICS Bank, or now called the New Development Bank, will have, as you said, equal shares, and they have left open the space for other countries to join. So maybe in a year or so, we could have Mexico, we could have Nigeria, a number of other countries can join as well, which would also increase the size. And possibly even the developed countries may be invited and may want to join, but in a minority. So it will be dominantly a BRICS bank, but with other memberships, which I think is interesting. So it will be like the World Bank, which is more dominated by the Americans and the Europeans and Japanese, but this will be the other way around.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is in the UK, in London, where she's currently the Financial Market Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And she briefed a committee of the UK Parliament today on the new BRICS bank announced from the 6th BRICS summit that just took place in Brazil, BRICS being Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Their new development bank has initial capital of $50 billion. It will be located in Shanghai. And you mentioned earlier about how this is a sort of alternative to the IMF and the World Bank. I mean, there are two things that seem to me to have contributed to a disquiet in the financial world and that's led to this BRICS bank. One, of course, is the 2008 crash, which is entirely, I think, to be blamed on Wall Street excesses, recklessness, exactly. Lack of oversight, government policies, et cetera. And that took the entire global economy to the brink of collapse. And the other thing, I think, is the Washington consensus on policies where they, you know, are pushing neoliberal policies, privatization, budget austerity, et cetera. And when you look at some of the more successful and growing economies in the world today, particularly China and Singapore, their growth is largely to do with a state-backed borrowing and investment industrial policy. So are those the ingredients in why these BRICS nations felt that they needed an alternative to the Bretton Woods Anglo-Saxon model?
I think you're quite right on both accounts. I mean, the first point is very strong in the sense that Wall Street and the City of London have focused on developing a financial sector which they've allowed to be completely liberalized and which has often gone into speculative activity. And what these countries need to grow and develop, in fact, also the United States and Europe, is investment in the real economy, and particularly long-term investment, infrastructure, in innovation, in renewable energy. And Wall Street and the City of London, obsessed as they are with short-term profits, cannot deliver that. And so there has been a shift towards, for example, public development banks at a national level. And these countries like China and Brazil, and indeed Germany also, have very large national public development banks. And now they're creating a BRICS development bank where you have public criteria. So although evaluated on a commercial basis, these projects have to be profitable, but they also have to serve long-term development needs. I just saw that the Chinese are talking to the Brazilians and the Peruvians about financing a railway which joins the Pacific and the Atlantic in South America. I mean, this is the kind of thing that is very difficult to finance nowadays through the private markets. But the BRICS Development Bank could think about that. And so it is this kind of real economy development, a financial sector, as we've discussed in the past, that serves the real economy, which these BRICS countries want to help create, and they want to be less dependent on Wall Street and the City of London. And also they want to push their own development strategy, which is uses a sort of developmental state as well as private sector, combines both public and private in the best interests of their people and in the best interests of growth, rather than having a model, a sort of Anglo-Saxon model imposed on them, as you say, you know, a sort of Washington consensus model. So it will also offer options. So if you're a small African country, you can choose to borrow from the World Bank, or you can choose to borrow from the New Development Bank. I mean, neither necessarily would be perfect, but the fact that you have the option would be very valuable. And they can, of course, collaborate, and both compete and collaborate. So I think it's a good idea because, you know, we talk about competition in private markets, but we should also have competition with public development banks. So the World Bank might be better because of the New Development Bank, and the new BRICS Development Bank may be better because it has to compete and show it's better than the World Bank. So I think it's quite a healthy balance, a new balance in the world economy.
Well, Stephanie Griffin-Jones, from what you're telling us, I'm immediately thinking, well, maybe the United States should start borrowing from the new BRICS Bank because our infrastructure has been left to deteriorate, tremendous underinvestment, and there are no banks in this country as they have in the rest of the world for municipal utilities, etc. Everything that every state and city in this country needs, they have to go to Wall Street for it. And as you say, Wall Street's priorities are to have, you know, high-speed computers as close as possible to the stock exchange so that they can do these ridiculously high-speed trades and just make money out of money. And it seems to be the trajectory we're on, where we have a financial system based on extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And I can't see in the long run that it's sustainable.
I think you're quite right. And but of course, the United States doesn't really need to. It could borrow from the BRICS Bank, but it has its own savings. So the United States should actually have an infrastructure bank. I mean, in the 30s, in the New Deal, you built so many dams and created so many national parks, and you have these massive financial resources. And instead of being channeled towards speculative activities like high-frequency trading, you should be investing them in long term. And I know that the administration has been very interested in the possibility of having such an infrastructure bank, which, of course, Europe has, the European Investment Bank. The UK, the Labour Party is thinking of creating a British Investment Bank. Germany has a big public development bank, which is the second largest commercial bank, KfW. So the U.S. is a little bit the outlier. And one should ask, you know, why don't you create an infrastructure development bank? Also because the United States, in the end, like the European countries, has to compete with these countries. And to compete, you have to have a functional financial system that helps you develop and grow and produce, innovate. And if you have a dysfunctional financial system, like unfortunately in many ways Wall Street and the City of London have become, it sort of inhibits the development of the real economy, and it frustrates, if you like, the creation of value added, of innovation and so on. So maybe you should think about it. I think that's a really good suggestion.
Well, I was being a little sarcastic.
I don't think necessarily borrow from the British Development Bank, but create your own.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a paradox of the United States.
Exactly. No,
you know, the most important economy in the world doesn't have such an infrastructure bank.
So let's turn a little bit here to the other big story going on in Europe at the moment, and that is the EU summit in Brussels, where they're poised to pick a new foreign policy chief to replace Catherine Ashton. And, of course, that's a key position, particularly because of the negotiations underway with Iran. And then, of course, Herman Van Rompuy, the council president, is being replaced. At the moment, two women are the lead, are the front runners, apparently, for the foreign policy chief is the Italian foreign minister. And for the to replace Van Rompuy is the former Danish prime minister, and who I think in many ways is, I don't know whether you've seen that wonderful Danish TV series, Borgen.
Of course.
Well, yes. She's somewhat the model, I think, Denmark's Helle Thorning-Schmidt. And, of course, Italy's foreign minister, Federica Mogherini, is also a front runner. But obviously what they're really talking about there, apart from these filling these positions, is what to do about Russia and Ukraine. And Angela Merkel has indicated as she arrived in Brussels that she's not happy about Russia's cooperation. And this comes at a time when the U.S. has just announced its increased sanctions against Russia over Ukraine, targeting major banks, defense and energy firms, among them Gazprom Bank and Rosneft, and senior officials in Russia and the self-declared rebel entities in eastern Ukraine. And now the Europeans are joining in with sanctions of their own.
Well, I think it's a very complicated situation with Ukraine. I think that maybe, I would think that perhaps the European Union had pushed things in Ukraine a little bit too fast, because they are a neighbor and used to be for parts of Ukraine, used to be part of Russia, particularly Crimea, which Putin has now annexated in not a very democratic way. But I think the sensitivities there are quite complex. And, of course, there are also very deep trade links, particularly with Germany, which depends for its energy to an important extent on Russian and Ukrainian gas and oil. So I think you need to have a toughness, but at the same time have the ability to negotiate, because you don't really want to go back to sort of Cold War. So I think there is a discussion also, there was possibility of other candidates and on foreign affairs, but I think the Italian ones may prove to be, besides being a woman, which is of course a good thing, but may also be an interesting choice, because Italy also is rather dependent on supply of energy from Russia and the countries of the former Soviet Union. So they will have a more nuanced approach. I think it's important to have a nuanced approach so that borders are respected. But on the other hand, so you don't destabilize. I mean, there are enough problems, for example, in the Middle East and in Iran and so on. So you don't want to create new tensions. Because I think Europe really should focus on growth and recovery, and particularly of employment. I mean, the situation is still in the periphery of Europe, in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, to a lesser extent in Ireland. I've recently been to Ireland, but levels of unemployment are still very, very high, particularly amongst the young. And so there needs to be a focus by Juncker and by the new European Commission on how to restore investment and growth and above all jobs.
Well, the Italian Foreign Minister, Federica Mogherini, of course, is the favourite, but apparently she's been criticised by a lot of the Eastern European countries for being too soft on Russia. So there you have the divide, right, between the more nuanced approach and the more hardline approach.
Exactly, like countries like Poland and the Baltic states that would like a tougher line.
Right.
Whereas the West Europeans, particularly the Germans and the Italians, because they're so integrated economically with Russia, and they may want to reduce that dependence, but this will take some time. So they will have a more nuanced approach.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I thank you very much for joining us here today from London.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. Again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Institute for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And today she briefed a committee of the UK Parliament on the new BRICS Development Bank announced by the BRICS nations from their sixth summit in Brazil. We're going to take a brief station break and discuss the wildly exaggerated xenophobic and racist claims on Fox News that immigrant children are carrying diseases across our border.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rachel Pearson, who's a sixth-year MD PhD student at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Institute for the Medical Humanities. She has an article at the Texas Observer, Disease Threat from Immigrant Children Wildly Overstated. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Pearson.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And, of course, your governor, Rick Perry, met recently with the president and presumably castigated him in private as he has in public, and had a completely distorted picture of this crisis on the border. What Governor Perry and other conservatives in this country are saying constantly, and they have been saying this for some time, in regard to the issue of immigration reform, that we need to beef up our border patrol. And you simply cannot beef the border patrol up more than it is beefed up already. And most of the beefing up has happened under the Obama administration. But that misses the point. These children crossing the border are not sneaking into America. They're surrendering. They're looking for somebody to surrender to. They want water. They want somebody to take them into the embrace of the United States. So is anybody calling Perry on this monstrous lie that somehow all these children are trying to sneak into America when, in fact, they are, you know, literally giving themselves up at the border?
Well, there has been some good reportage out of the Dallas Morning News and my colleagues at the Texas Observer. But, you know, in general, a lot of the media response has picked up the conservative rhetoric about how we're supposed to understand this crisis. So what's most concerning to me about Obama's response is that it's largely been an effort to continue militarizing the border, as you pointed out. And so some people are picking up the idea that, you know, this is a humanitarian crisis, or even arguing that these children should be considered to be refugees. But for the most part, there is widespread acceptance that our national response should involve militarizing the border. And, you know, from a healthcare perspective, increased militarization on the border is not really going to protect anybody's health and safety.
And in your article, Rachel Pearson at the Texas Observer, disease threat from immigrant children wildly overstated, that sort of ties into what we're talking about in terms of how this is being framed by the right wing. And of course, we have a media in this country that's largely dominated by right-wing politics, that you've got people like U.S. Representative Louie Gohmert, a Texas Republican, basically saying that these kids are all bringing diseases into the country. And so is Fox News commentator Cal Thomas and others. That reminds me of Lou Dobbs when he was back on CNN, used to keep talking about all of the diseases crossing the border until finally CNN found him unpalatable. So is this an old canard? But as you point out, actually it backfires. It's actually more embarrassing when, as you point out in your article, it turns out that the United States has less immunization against the very diseases that Louie Gohmert and others on Fox News are saying are being brought into the country, such as measles, etc. So walk us through that, if you will.
Sure. So, like you mentioned, a lot of the more conservative media outlets and Texas politicians, political leaders, have been saying that these kids are bringing, quote, diseases that we have eradicated in the United States across the border. And measles is one of the examples they give. Now, that idea that people from Central America are full of diseases is simply a stereotype. And if you look at the facts, these kids are more likely to be immunized than American kids for measles. There has not been a reported outbreak of measles in Guatemala or Honduras since 1990, whereas in the United States, there's been a resurgence of measles as people have, you know, chosen not to vaccinate their kids. That's a political issue I don't wish to get into. But again, if you look at what the doctors who are actually working on the border, who are actually have been in the detention centers or who have been at crisis centers that are treating these kids, what they say is that the diseases they're seeing are normal childhood complaints. So twisted ankle from their journey, upset stomachs, strep throat, kids get strep throat all the time. There was a statement from the Health Department of Texas Saturday, I believe, that said that among the 57,000 children that have been detained in Texas, there have been 3 cases of flu, 3 cases of tuberculosis, and 23 cases of chickenpox. And again, with respect to flu, that's a totally normal childhood illness. 3 cases among 57,000 kids really shouldn't be concerning to anyone. With respect to tuberculosis is a serious disease, but all of these kids are being screened for tuberculosis, and the fact that they're, you know, catching a very few cases is something that we should expect. Those kids should get access to care to treat them for their tuberculosis. And then with respect to the chickenpox, the United States is one of the only countries in the world, or one of very few countries, that universally vaccinate against chickenpox. And in fact, when we started vaccinating against chickenpox in 1995, a lot of physicians were against instituting universal vaccination because it's such a mild disease. It's like a self-limiting rash that lasts a couple weeks, and it's very itchy and uncomfortable. But serious complications of chickenpox are very, very rare. So most countries in the world do not vaccinate against chickenpox, including European countries and including Central America. So again, 23 cases of chickenpox, not very concerning. And if anybody's worried that chickenpox is going to spread to surrounding communities, they can take comfort in the fact that 90% of Americans, including Texans, are vaccinated against chickenpox by age 3.
Well, as you point out in your article, Rachel Pearson, in the Texas Observer, disease threats from immigrant children wildly overstated. UNICEF reports that 93% of kids in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have been vaccinated against measles, and that's better than the U.S. average, which is 92%. And although you said that you didn't want to get into this political issue of of not vaccinating, the truth of the matter is that it's not a political issue. It's an anti-intellectual issue, because it, as opposed to brown-skinned kids coming from our border who our xenophobes and racists are saying are ridden with disease and going to infect us all, the problem in the United States comes from sort of new age yuppie parents who listen to airhead actresses like Jenny McCarthy and don't vaccinate their kids. And it's entirely anti-intellectual. The science doesn't support it. So I don't call it a political issue so much as an anti-intellectual issue.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I'm with you on that. A lot of the researchers who look at the families who choose not to vaccinate call that choice denialism, and they equate that kind of science denialism with denialism of, you know, belief in global warming, for example, or belief in the theory of evolution. So the level of evidence that vaccines are safe and effective is so high. And has been restudied over and over since this controversy started. Vaccines are safe and effective.
But the study that this canard is based on, that was published in The Lancet, all the people involved with that study have been discredited. Some have gone to jail, and The Lancet has refuted it and apologized.
Exactly.
So just back to the issue then of the 57,000 children on our borders, that it's become a political football, and it's clearly a problem for President Obama, who prior to this influx of children was in fact trying to figure out ways via executive order that he could make our situation on the borders, and particularly with the millions of undocumented people living in this country, more humane. That seems to be taken off the table. What's the mood down in Texas? You mentioned that it's not entirely, not everybody in Texas goes along with the xenophobia of Governor Perry, but what's your sense then of where things stand and where they're likely to head, particularly in this election year?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say where the political winds of Texas will turn. I do think that there are some promising developments and some responses to these kids' horrible situation that are humane and compassionate. The city of Dallas is really leading the state in putting together a compassionate response. They volunteered to take in 2,000 of the kids, and you know, they're organizing a humane medical response, and they're having to do a whole lot of, you know, aggressive public relations to get the people of Dallas to understand that these kids don't constitute a health threat, that they're just, you know, adorable kids from Central America, essentially. So, you know, there's some promising developments, people acting out of the best part of themselves, but there's also still a lot of fear and a lot of racism. I mean, a lot of this anti-immigration stuff is essentially about race. It's about fear of people thought of as outsiders, and the fact that, you know, those really ugly ways of thinking and those really ugly forces can be turned against children. It's very disturbing.
Again, I'm speaking with Rachel Pearson, who's a six-year MD, PhD student at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Institute for the Medical Humanities. She has an article at the Texas Observer, Disease Threat from Immigrant Children Wildly Overstated. So how is this translating, though, in terms of the faith-based communities? Because much of Texas politics on the right apparently is based in a kind of Christian evangelical conservatism. Are people, you know, responding to the real intention of the Bible and the prophet Jesus to take care of the poor and the sick and the needy? What's your reading on efforts from faith-based groups to address this humanitarian crisis on the border?
Well, you know, it's really mixed. I think that some of the most human and humane responses are coming from faith-based groups, from Catholic ministries and from Refugee Services of Texas, which collaborates with a lot of faith-based groups. You know, they're really organizing people to try and help. And it's, again, hard for me to speak to what's going on inside all those evangelical mega churches. I would be very interested to know. But I would hope that if they are preaching the anti-immigration narrative, that they are also trying to teach people how to care for the most suffering and vulnerable people among us, which, again, kids, poor kids.
So in terms of then, as somebody that's going to be a practicing physician soon, and you're at the University of Texas Medical School and also the Institute for the Medical Humanities, what is the level then of medical response in terms of, you know, what I was saying earlier is that these kids are not, as Governor Perry says we need more border patrol because somehow they're sneaking in here illegally, when in fact they're surrendering, and many of them are looking for water because crossing the deserts, particularly in Arizona, are fatal to many. So what immediate responses are there in terms of the real human needs, not these xenophobic, ginned-up fears of diseases, mythical diseases coming across the border, but real medical needs?
Right. So we're seeing a lot of doctors on the border volunteering their time to try to care for these kids. The Texas Medical Association has called on Governor Perry to fund a more robust and organized medical response. And, you know, what they really, the main concerns of the Texas Medical Association are that these kids get the care that they need and also that they don't spread infectious disease. So in their call for more funding from Dr. Perry, Governor Perry, the TMA did mention the threat of the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases. And so the reason that I bring that up is just to point out that even among medical professionals, the perception that these kids are dangerous, that they're a health threat, is widespread. I think it comes from just, you know, on the one hand, stereotypes that are pretty prevalent in our culture. And then on the other hand, not just taking the time to look into what are the actual vaccination rates in Central America, what are the facts. And then finally, on that point, I would note that some of the most vociferous rhetoric about these kids being a health threat has come from individual ultra-conservative physicians collaborating with news outlets. So these are physicians who have an anti-immigration bone to pick, and they are spreading fear. They're using their, you know, status as a physician to spread fear. When I think about doctors doing that, I'm always reminded of the narrative of this Japanese physician who survived the bombing of Nagasaki. He wrote that in Chinese, the character physician is the same as the character for comforter. That's an essential part of what we should be doing, especially in times like these. We should be comforting people, and that docs are going out and using their position to frighten people. I think it's really gives our profession a poor name.
And of course, an example of that is Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet, a Fox News commentator, who's been spreading this kind of hateful xenophobia on the air.
Yeah, she's kind of, from what I can tell, she's not overly concerned with epidemiological facts. She's more concerned with her agenda.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rachel Pearson. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Again, Rachel Pearson's a six-year MD, PhD student at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Institute for the Medical Humanities, and she has an article at the Texas Observer, Disease Threat from Immigrant Children Wildly Overstated. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.